From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As President Trump began his trip to Asia this morning, he was questioned about the news this week that he was in a meeting during the campaign when now indicted former aide George Papadopoulos said he could broker a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
I don't remember much about that meeting. It was a very unimportant meeting, took place a long time. Don't remember much about it.
And he said he didn't know if he would fire Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who was also in that meeting, but he's sure disappointed Sessions is not investigating Democrats.
Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. And joining us today, Maria Elena Salinas, news anchor at Univision. Hi, Maria Elena.
Hi, good to talk to you.
Good to have you back again. And Chad Pergram, who covers Capitol Hill for Fox News. Hi, Chad.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
And let's start with the president's comments this morning. He was asked if he would fire Jeff Sessions. Let's listen.
I don't know. I'm really not involved with the Justice Department. I'd like to let it run itself. But honestly, they should be looking at the Democrats. They should be looking at Podesta and all of that dishonesty. They should be looking at a lot of things. And a lot of people are disappointed in the Justice Department, including me. Thank you, everybody.
Chad, what do you make of it?
Well, this is the $64,000 question in Washington as people are trying to figure out, you know, does this wash up on the president in any way, shape or form? You know, there was a lot of moving around here where people thought, well, maybe this would be a situation where the president might fire or try to undercut the special counsel, Robert Mueller. Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina on the Senate Judiciary Committee, when I asked, you know, what would happen if the president were to do that, he said, quote, there would be holy hell to pay. Mm-hmm. And just this morning, Matt Gaetz, who is a Republican freshman congressman from Florida, has introduced a non-binding resolution for the House of Representatives that would basically say, you know, we think that Robert Mueller is not handling this well and should recuse himself.
Well, but Maria Elena, we're not quite sure why the president was asked about Sessions. It was so noisy there at the helicopter. But as you know, Democrats on Capitol Hill are demanding that he return for more questioning because not only was he in that meeting with George Papadopoulos and the documents that were revealed when indictments were handed down this week revealed that he said in that meeting, no more talk about meeting with the Russians, you know, that this might be leaked, stop talking. So he batted it down, but he knew about it. And then we now know that former foreign policy advisor Carter Page testified yesterday that he told Sessions he was going to have meetings in Russia last year. And as we know, Jeff Sessions said he hadn't heard nothing about Russian attempts to involve in the election. So I mean, we're not sure if the president is talking about firing him over Russia or firing him for his department not investigating Democrats. What's going on?
I think probably the reason why you're hearing him talk about whether the FBI and the Department of Justice should be investigating the Democrats is just to divert attention precisely from this situation. You know, it's no wonder that Mr. Sessions insisted that he did not remember. Who's going to dispute, you know, an older man's memory? You know, he was covering himself just the way that the president was covering himself. You know, with Mr. Carter's testimony does prove that Sessions knew that he was going to Russia. But Sessions could easily defend himself, saying that it was unrelated to the Trump campaign. But, you know, even more damning than Carter Page's testimony is George Papadopoulos' picture sitting in that conference room with the president and with Mr. Sessions, and where he was offering to set up a meeting with the Russians. Even if they rejected the meeting, they at least knew that there was an attempt to collude. So both Sessions and Trump would be lying.
But Chad, I just want to know, do you think Sessions is going to be heading back to Congress?
Well, that's something that people here, certainly on the Democratic side of the aisle, would like to do. They would like to have him before the Senate Judiciary Committee again. They were not very pleased with his performance a few weeks ago when he came up here to talk about matters. Again, this was supposed to be just a routine oversight hearing, but they talked about a lot of other things. And to also weigh in here for a moment on the Carter Page situation, I was told by my sources familiar with his lengthy meeting yesterday, and one of the reasons I was told it took so long, he was there from about 9 to about 5:30. It was the longest interview that the House Intelligence Committee has conducted with any witness so far, and we're going to get a transcript of this here in a few days, is that his answers were very long-winded, labyrinthine, they weren't clear. And the reason that it didn't seem to send off alarm bells, at least according to people familiar with what Carter Page said, was that he had told Sessions that he was going to Russia to give a speech at a university, and that didn't send up these red flags with the Trump campaign at the time. Yeah.
I think that was the first time we've ever had the word labyrinthian
on
the
it.
Show, and we loved it. Now, Maria Elena, let me ask you about what's been going on with the Democrats. We got this book excerpt released yesterday from the former DNC chair Donna Brazile's book, and she says Hillary Clinton took control of day-to-day operations a year before she defeated Bernie Sanders last year due to a financial agreement that gave Clinton control because the DNC was so debt-ridden and she was sharing her fundraising with them. Was that a shock or not?
I don't think so. It should come as no surprise to anyone. You know, accusations of the DNC, you know, that was tilted toward Clinton have been around since the primary. It's no secret that Clinton thought Bernie Sanders was getting in the way and splitting the vote so badly that she so badly needed not just to win the nomination, but to win the election. I think that the real question here is why? Why now? Why talk about this now? The election is over. The Democratic Party is trying to regroup, clean up their wounds, and try to retake at least the Senate in 2018. And this just gives Republicans, especially President Trump, more ammunition to attack the Democrats. So why now?
What's your answer?
I don't imagine it's an act of contrition. I don't think it's wanting to come clean. You know, that's usually not the way politicians operate. Maybe it's just a way to purge the party even more and distance itself from the Clinton debacle that at the end proved to be very toxic for the party.
Guys, you want to know something? Just came from a press conference with Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader. And one of the reasons I thought I might be a minute or so late getting over here to be on the air with you is I was trying to press Pelosi about this. I asked her if she believes these allegations that were made by Donna Brazile, who was the interim chair that talked about how bad the finances were. Pelosi completely punted. She said she wasn't involved. She said, I don't have any interest in things I'm not involved in. And I said, but wait a minute, this deals with fundraising. You are a major fundraiser for the Democratic Party. And she bragged for a minute. She said, in fact, I'm the biggest. And I said, well, yes, that's the reason we'd like to hear what you have to say about this. And she completely punted about this. Huh. And Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, basically did the same thing when pressed in a similar fashion yesterday.
Well, maybe this is all about teeing somebody else up, you know, setting somebody else up for, you know, 4 years from now on CNN yesterday. Here's what Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren told host Jake Tapper.
This is a real problem. But what we've got to do as Democrats now is we've got to hold this party accountable.
Very quickly, Senator, do you agree with the notion that it was rigged?
Yes.
Well, and Maria Elena, we all remember the protestations, you know, at the conventions. Oh, that's silly. You know, when people, especially Bernie Sanders supporters, were saying it was rigged. What does this do to the party?
Yeah, I remember perfectly. I remember the convention when they had that sit-in in the area where the journalists were. I think what happened in the past is that since they thought Clinton was the inevitable candidate, it's probably why they were raising funds together. They never expected anyone else to give her any kind of competition. So to them, it was probably something normal. And yes, the party right now wants to look like it's united, but things like this are dividing them. So they're trying everything possible to distance themselves, like I said before, from this whole Clinton debacle. That's why a lot of Democrats are out saying they wish that Hillary Clinton would just go away. You know, right now she's out promoting her book, she's out giving speeches, and they just want to put that behind them and just move forward.
Mm-hmm. All right, we have to talk about the Republican tax cut proposal, which came out yesterday. This is something that could impact every single American. This is House Speaker Paul Ryan taking a question from a reporter.
If Republicans can't get this done, do you deserve to control the Congress?
What's your second question? We're going to get this done. You know why? Because the American people are counting on us. We're going to get this done because we told the American people this is what we're going to do if we get this majority. And guess what? We're doing it.
Now, Chad, we spoke with Mara Liasson yesterday, who said that this thing may die a death by a thousand cuts. We spoke with an economist today who said it's not going to pass in anything like the form that it's in now. What do you think?
Well, consider how much time it took to move Obamacare. Votes in the House in November of 2009, vote in the Senate in December of 2010, and then a final vote merging the packages in March of 2010. That took 5-6 months right there. The fact that they want to do this by Christmas is very tough. I talked to one skeptical member from a district that would be hit who didn't want to be identified by this when they walked out of the meeting yesterday, and I said, what do you think? And the quote was, I think it sucks, close quote. Now, I'm going to tell you about three members to look at. You talk about the New York and New Jersey members are the ones to watch in this. John Katko, Elise Stefanik, and Claudia Tenney. They are Republicans from New York State. If they vote yes or signal their support for this, this bill is probably going to pass. When they approved the budget resolution, which is the framework for this a couple of weeks ago, the vote was 216-212. You could only lose two votes. So that shows you they have no margin for error. And so if they lose anybody else, maybe some California Republicans, people from a high-tax state, this bill is toast.
Maria Elena Salinas, go ahead. Just a few seconds.
I just wanted to add to that the Congress is investing, congressional Republicans are investing most of their political capital on this tax plan. The real problem is within their own party. It's not only on the House side, but also on the Senate side. There's at least three Republican senators, Jeff Flake, Susan Collins, and Marco Rubio, who said they're not in.
They're not in.
So they definitely need a political win and able to survive.
Maria Elena Salinas, a news anchor at Univision.
And Chad Pergram, Fox News senior producer at Capitol Hill. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Following the accusations about Harvey Weinstein, the allegations of sexual harassment continue to come across many industries. One of the latest to be accused is David Korn of Mother Jones magazine, who's been accused of making inappropriate comments and giving unwelcome shoulder rubs to several women. Korn says he's never touched any colleagues in a sexual way. Many people are welcoming this movement of openness and accountability. Our next guest, though, thinks it may be going too far. Kathy Young is a contributing editor at Reason. She wrote an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times titled, "Is Weinsteining Getting Out of Hand?" She joins us on Skype. Kathy, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And do you think that Weinsteining, as you call it, is getting out of hand?
Up front, I think that there is a definitely positive aspect to what's going on, which is that, people who have been quiet about sexual assault and serious sexual harassment have been coming forward. I think that that is unquestionably a good thing. What really worries me is that we are seeing, sort of very broad definitions of sexual harassment. We're seeing a lot of claims about things that happened a number of years ago that may be fairly trivial. On the one hand, I think it is, as I said, a positive thing, but we do have to be careful, I think, about sort of unquestioningly crediting every accusation that gets made, especially on this kind of upsurge of the sort of mass wave of people talking about these experiences. I really don't want to try to discredit anyone, but I think it is useful to remember that when you have this kind of wave of popular sentiment on the issue, sometimes people will try to get on the bandwagon and, either exaggerate or even make things up. It has happened before.
Well, and there's a big difference between what Harvey Weinstein is accused of and what some others have been accused of. How do you navigate that when, in some cases, the allegations are not of rape or sexual assault, but an uncomfortable conversation?
Right. And I think we are talking about a lot of highly subjective issues. We're also talking about things that I think may sometimes appear differently to people in retrospect than they did, maybe 5 or 10 years ago when it happened. I think we know that people have a tendency to sort of edit their memories. And I think when there is this kind of laser focus on sexual misconduct in the workplace, people may sometimes reassess a conversation that happened 10 years ago that felt perfectly okay at the time. Suddenly now it may seem to be serious misconduct, or it may seem to be incredibly creepy when we're so focused on this issue. So, what I would like to see is just for people to kind of step back a little and make sure that we're not, destroying people for no good reason.
Well, and it brings up another point, which is that in some cases, the accusers are anonymous or allowed to be anonymous because they fear that their job prospects would be hurt if they come forward and say their name. But the accused is not given that same luxury.
Oh, exactly. And, it is a very, very difficult issue to navigate because, again, on the one hand, I think you can totally understand why some people want to stay anonymous when talking about these issues, not only because of possible retaliation, but because it is an incredibly personal and sort of intimate issue to talk about. On the other hand, again, you know, we do have this basic issue of fairness to the accused. And we're not necessarily talking about the legal process here, but I think, you know, even outside the legal process, the right to confront your accuser really is pretty basic. And if we're having people brought down on the basis of anonymous accusations, I think that is quite concerning.
Should accusations of wrongdoing from decades ago be able to get somebody fired today?
Well, I think, again, I would take this on a case-by-case basis. If we're talking about allegations of rape or sexual assault or, you know, sexual coercion, where someone is told, you know, if you don't sleep with me, you're not going to get this role or something like that. And if there is actual evidence to back this up, or if there's more than one story where people independently of each other have these sort of very similar stories that do show a pattern, I think on some things, you know, there really should be no statute of limitations. On the other hand, again, if we're talking about these things that are very subjective, that lend themselves to a lot of interpretation, to a lot of sort of selective memory, I just am very uncomfortable about some of the things that have happened. If this continues, or maybe even now, I think a backlash is going to happen. And ultimately, the backlash is going to hurt people who are coming forward with very serious stories of misconduct.
Have you gotten any backlash for what you wrote in the LA Times about this?
I have from a few people, and I've had the sort of the usual, you know, how can you as a woman sort of let other women down kind of reaction. And, you know, my response to that is, I don't think that we owe loyalty to people on the basis of gender. And I think there's a lot of different opinions on this. And I think one of the reasons that I actually wanted to write this piece is to show that there isn't, you know, a single female voice that speaks for everyone. Because I've certainly heard, you know, many women privately express these views to me and express these concerns.
That's Kathy Young, who is a contributing editor at Reason. And we'll link you to her op-ed in the LA Times. It's called "Is Weinsteining Getting Out of Hand?" Kathy, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And as we are seeing all these allegations play out in real life, how are things playing out on the screen? NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us with more on that. And Eric, has the industry brought the issue of sexual harassment into the shows?
Well, it's interesting because I think we're seeing two things kind of play out at the same time. On the one hand, we're seeing shows that seem to reflect and reinforce this harassment culture in storylines. I was just watching an episode of a show called Designated Survivor on ABC, and there's a female FBI agent in that show, and she's investigating something with a British agent that she doesn't like. And the guy comes over to her apartment, and then he sort of kisses her out of the blue, and instead of her pushing him away, she responds to it. And it's that kind of thing where a woman is resistant to a guy until he forces himself on her that people have criticized a lot. At the same time that we're seeing stuff like that, we're also seeing some TV shows try to talk about how difficult the issue of sexual harassment can be. Aziz Ansari's Netflix show Master of None had a situation where a popular TV chef turned out to be accused of sexual harassment, even though he didn't even realize what he was doing. Seemingly, he didn't seem to realize what he was doing. And we have a clip. Let's check out that clip.
Have you been on the internet? Your buddy Chef Jeff is a pervert.
What?
Apparently he's been harassing women for years, and now Chef Jeff is a pervert. It's trending on Twitter.
So what's interesting about this situation is that Aziz's character winds up not exactly confronting the TV chef because he wants to safeguard his own career, which is the sad reality of some of this stuff. So I think he kind of portrayed it in a very authentic way.
Okay, so that's one example. What's another?
Well, Amazon has a show called One Mississippi that features the comedian Tig Notaro. And there was a storyline there where first she and the producer of this radio show that she was doing talked about harassment and talked about molestation and how sometimes women can be harassed and molested and not even realize that it's happening, especially when they're young. And then a situation comes where this producer is stuck in an office with someone and he does something awful while she's there. And then Tig confronts this person who did this awful thing in front of her producer. And we have a clip of that, too. Let's check it out.
Hey, Jack.
Hey, what's up?
I don't know. Maybe you can tell me. My colleague said she witnessed something pretty disturbing in your office this morning.
I don't know what you're talking about.
She said you masturbated in front of her.
What?
I was probably just scratching myself.
So what's interesting and a little meta about this situation is that Louis C.K. is an executive producer on the show, but he's not involved with the making of it, according to Tig Notaro. But he's been accused of harassing some of the young comics who opened for him when he was a stand-up a few years ago. He has avoided those questions, and I think he may have denied them as well. But it's interesting that they would have a scene like this in a show where he's the executive producer, and Tig herself has said that Louis C.K. needs to do a better job of addressing the allegations.
You know, Eric, these allegations have come so fast, not just in Hollywood, but in other industries as well, including our own, where the NPR Senior Vice President for News just resigned this week after sexual harassment allegations against him. And all along the way, I've noticed that some of the people who have worked with these people who have been accused will say, oh, yeah, I knew that. We all knew that was going on. Did you know that it was as widespread as it was in Hollywood?
That's one of those things where I think a good example might be, say, Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby has been accused by, up to and over 50 women of drugging and raping them or sexually harassing them in some way. Now, I think there were a lot of people who knew that he had been unfaithful to his wife a lot. I don't think that there were a lot of people that necessarily suspected he might have been doing that, drugging and raping women. That's a level of behavior that I think he kept hidden if he's guilty of it. And I think the same thing might be true of someone like Weinstein. People knew that he would hit on young actresses a lot. They knew that he cheated on his wife. They didn't necessarily know the extent to which he was taking it. That's a level of activity that I would be shocked if a wide range of people knew about it.
Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic, thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.
And what is going on in Oklahoma? Dozens of school districts are down to 4-day weeks. A Republican state lawmaker compared state workers to terrorists. The former 2-time mayor of Tulsa joked that he came out of the closet because he called for higher taxes on oil producers. As Republicans in Washington look to slash taxes on the federal level, Oklahoma is battling over putting some back. Just like Kansas, where a Republican-led legislature and Tea Party-backed governor cut taxes in 2012 and went off a fiscal cliff, Oklahoma cut taxes and is now trying to plug a $215 million hole in the budget 6 weeks into a special session. Jacob McClelland is news director at KGOU in Norman. And Jacob, your governor, Mary Fallon, was also Tea Party backed in 2010, reduced state income taxes, kept generous breaks to oil and gas producers. What's been the result?
Well, there's been several things that have happened. As you mentioned earlier, schools, teachers haven't received a pay raise in quite some time. The prison system is overcrowded. And right now, if some of these agencies, especially these health agencies, don't see some of that funding renewed, we're talking about all outpatient services being eliminated from the state's mental health and substance abuse services. And the state's Medicaid agency has said that they may have to reduce the reimbursement rate to medical providers by 9%.
This is, as we said, a Republican-led legislature. There's disagreement even within the Republican faction. People who want to raise some taxes on the oil industry and those who don't.
Yeah, that's right. And really, a lot of this comes back to a cigarette tax that was passed during the regular session. It was ruled unconstitutional, though, because in Oklahoma, you need a 3/4 majority to pass any revenue-raising measure. So now Republicans are split. There's a sizable faction that don't want to raise taxes, while the Republican leadership has considered a tax on fuel and a tax on beer. But to pass any of that, they need Democratic support, and Democrats won't budge unless there are some increases on the oil and gas production tax rate as well.
Well, Oklahoma does have some of the lowest taxes on oil production, 2%. And we mentioned your governor there, Mary Fallon. Even she, I understand, has changed her mind, has said, no, we need to do this. We need to get some more revenue out of this industry. you know, she backed the cuts before and now can't get anyone to change their mind?
Yeah, it's kind of complicated. Fallon actually said that she would veto any budget bill that would cut services. But right now, without having any real revenue-raising measures that'll cover that entire $215 million hole, they're looking at revenue-raising measures where they need really only 51%, which is repealing some incentives on older oil and gas wells, and really just kind of looking into any account where they may have some extra money and funneling that into agencies that are about to run out of money.
We mentioned a Republican rep calling state workers terrorists. These are some of the healthcare workers who are saying they just can't do their work without some more money. And others are, you know, trolling each other. Some language has been thrown around. What kind of pressure has this been?
It's been pretty chippy and kind of bizarre at times. We did have the Speaker of the House last week in front of a bunch of reporters call a couple of Democratic lawmakers, telling them that what they were doing was a bunch of bull manure.
Yes.
And the House Minority Leader resigned and suspended his gubernatorial campaign at the same time. And some of these agencies, especially the Mental Health Agency and the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority and the Department of Human Services, they only have funding going for a few months. So it's really kind of getting to the point where if new revenue isn't found soon, they could be cutting services.
Jacob McLelland, news director at KTOU, Norman, Oklahoma. Jacob, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
We know scientists say that one solution to global warming is to cut carbon emissions by using energy more efficiently and, wherever possible, to replace fossil fuels with renewables like wind, solar, and hydropower. But producing renewable energy can come with its own costs, as we're reminded when reporter Dan Grossman travels to an indigenous community in Panama.
Our story begins in Quiad, a village in western Panama. This is where the indigenous Nove Bugale adherents of the Mama Tata religion gather every year to worship and to pass on their myths and traditions. Manola Miranda is getting this tiny town of several dozen people ready to put up and feed a couple hundred pilgrims. He's digging post holes for rough-hewn logs to hold up a rustic pavilion where travelers can stay cool and, if it rains, dry.
We're on the eve of the celebration of our ancestors and the markings they left on stones as a symbol of our people.
The markings that he's talking about are centuries-old petroglyphs that are the sacred texts of Mama Tata, a blend of Christian and native beliefs that originated in the 1960s when an indigenous woman experienced a vision of the Virgin Mary. Many of the 250,000 Nove Bugle who live in this Delaware-sized territory in Panama's Chiriquí province practice it. The most cherished carvings are drawings etched into haystack-sized boulders midstream in the Tabasará River, close to where I'm standing. But this year, visitors who come here won't see the cryptic stick figures. For the first time that anyone here knows, the river has risen dramatically, submerging the religious symbols below several feet of murky water.
How could I talk about that with younger generations if I can no longer tell them, here it is, when we have a project that has erased our history, our existence?
The project is a new 20-story-high hydroelectric dam named Barro Blanco that backed up the river. Bulu Bagama paddles a dugout canoe. He's showing me his former farm. It now sits right below the boat.
Now let's go in the direction of where my house was. It's now underwater. My God, may he help me.
You used to be able to cross the Tasabar River here easily, skipping rock to rock across rapids. Now it looks like a lake. Leafless crowns of newly drowned trees poke through its surface. Bulu Bagama uses the bleached branches as landmarks for this tour.
All of that is orange trees. See? All those dried trees are orange trees. All of this here was a big farm, a banana farm. 1,500 banana trees that occupied this land.
The private owner of the dam purchased land immediately around the project, but not any of this indigenous territory. It wasn't for sale. The Nové Bouglé weren't asked and never agreed to let their land be flooded. In 2014, a UN human rights official warned Panama not to let the dam flood indigenous land. The company said that the impact of the project would be minimal and that nobody would have to move. But several dozen people were displaced. At an encampment within sight of the dam, several dozen Nové Bouglé people, dressed in colorful traditional handmade clothing, hold a permanent protest rally.
¿Qué pide el pueblo? Salvación, blanco. ¿Qué pide el pueblo?
What do the people want? Chants Clementina Perez Jimenez, one of their fiery leaders. Remove Barro Blanco, they yell back. The tribe opposed Barro Blanco from the day it was proposed in 2007. They blockaded the Pan-American Highway, which passes nearby, and at times clashed violently with police. But the company prevailed.
The protests, supposedly by the Noves, are actually not by the Noves, are by other interests who use the Noves to show protest.
Eduardo Vallarino, president of the Panamanian Association of Renewable Energy Producers, says indigenous opposition is a smokescreen for oil and natural gas producers trying to quash the competition. The petroglyphs are a red herring, says Vallarino. Dig them up and move them away, he says.
They can be taken out and conserved. That's not a problem. So they're looking at everything they can in order to stop things.
And Vallarino insists that the amount of indigenous shoreline that's been flooded is trivial. But Osvaldo Jordan, a human rights activist in Panama City who's advising the Nové Bouglé, says it's not the quantity of indigenous land destroyed that's the issue.
What about if I tell you I'm going to clip one of your fingers?
That's what destroying even a little bit of native territory feels like to them, says Jordan. He says the company and country of Panama, which licensed the dam, violated international law requiring that indigenous groups be permitted free, prior, and informed consent. The Nové Bouglé never agreed to let their territory be flooded, he says.
It is the equivalent that you own your house and this company comes, it floods part of your property without your consent or without, you know, you reaching an agreement.
Not long ago, two European banks that invested in the dam tried to calm things down. They sent representatives to Kiad and two other affected villages who asked the Nové Bouglé audience to look forward. But the indigenous people just want their land back. They're asking international groups, including the Organization of American States, to pressure Panama to return water in their territory to its natural level. For Here and Now, I'm Daniel Grossman, reporting from Kiad, Panama.
And Dan's story was funded in part by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Okay, let's take a quick look at the new numbers out today in the Labor Department's October jobs report. The headline, it's good news. The U.S. added 261,000 jobs last month. The unemployment rate was 4.1%. Michael Regan of Bloomberg News is here. And Mike, September was a terrible month with Hurricanes Irma and Harvey keeping people out of work. October seems back on track, but maybe less than what economists expected.
Well, right. And it really goes to speak to how difficult it is for economists to predict these numbers. The estimates in our Bloomberg survey were really all over the map. But the good thing about September is that the numbers were actually revised higher with this report. So originally it looked like there was a loss of 18,000 jobs. Now they're saying a gain of about 33,000 jobs. Oh, I'm sorry. I got that wrong. It was originally a loss of 33,000 jobs, and now it looks like a gain of 18,000 jobs.
Right.
So it's clear the payback from that weak month was included in this report.
Well, those jobs reports in September also affected the wage reports that we're getting now, because the wages look higher. It looks like there was a huge jump in wages in October, but that's because in September, all these people that were in, you know, kind of low-paying industry, the service industry, restaurants, they were out of work, so the average was higher. But where are we on wages?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the general thinking among economists had long been that as the unemployment rate drops, which it continues to do, that wages would go up. But it hasn't really worked out that way. And one of the things being blamed is the fact that the labor force participation rate, in other words, the number of people actually in the labor force, is still pretty low. So as the unemployment rate goes down, it's sort of luring more people back into the labor force. And that's helping to keep wages down because the competition isn't as strong.
Well, and what do you think, in a minute that we have, what do you think looking ahead? We've got a new, we are going to have a new head of the Federal Reserve. Do you think we're going to see an interest rate hike before Janet Yellen goes out? What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. It looks like there most likely will be a quarter percentage point increase in December. And the question is, how many will there be in 2018? The Fed has predicted 3, and the market's a little skeptical of that. They're predicting fewer than that.
Okay, and how might that affect – now you've got a half a minute. How might that affect the jobs?
Well, we'll have to see. If the job growth continues to be strong and these wage pressures continue to increase, it certainly will inspire the Fed to be maybe a little more aggressive with rate hikes.
All right. Well, now you got nothing. Mike Regan, Bloomberg Gadfly columnist. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's been a couple weeks since the deadline, and we still don't know where Amazon is going to put its second headquarters, but 238 cities have appealed to the online retail giant. Amazon plans to invest over $5 billion and create as many as 50,000 jobs, so it's a big economic opportunity for the city that is chosen, and many of those cities have offered tax incentives to catch Amazon's attention. But one major U.S. city decided not to bid, San Antonio, Texas. Mayor Ron Nuremberg joins us now on Skype. Mayor, why did you say no thanks to Amazon?
We didn't really say no thanks. What we said was a company like Amazon, which is forward-thinking, is looking for a place to settle that will be a strong long-term investment. One of the reasons why we view San Antonio to be a strong city of the future is because we have we are working on that, and we are building the infrastructure, educating the citizens, and doing the things that a city needs to do to be a strong and, you know, forward-looking place for the future. And we want to focus on that. We're in control of our destiny. And that's the reason why we are a strong investment, not because we're going to throw extra zeros of taxpayer dollars at a company. And I think that smart companies will see that.
So it sounds like this is really about tax incentives. You didn't want to offer those kinds of tax incentives that a lot of other places are in order to try to lure Amazon.
Right. And the thing is, what a company like Amazon is looking for is a city, a region that is investing in itself, that is taking care of the infrastructure demands of the future, that is meeting the challenges of workforce and education of the future. And why would we mortgage that future just to bring Amazon here when that would compromise the whole reason why a company would seek to invest in our city in the first place?
But a lot of cities sort of justify these tax incentives by saying, well, if we get 50,000 jobs, that's going to offset the cost of this.
Well, I think the jury is still out on that. In fact, you know, there is a extraordinary impact that will be felt across the public and the private sectors for absorbing a company of that size, no matter what city it settles in. And we want to be able to do that, but we do that by having strong public investment in, you know, our transportation system, our air services, our education system, and so forth. And, you know, San Antonio has been called America's 21st century city for a lot of reasons. One of them is the challenges of the future in terms of a new demographic, the new America. We are what America will look like 2 and 3 decades from now. And so we are already meeting the challenges of the future today. And in order to continue to do that and build the strong city that we believe we are, we're going to have to continue to make those investments. And, and putting those investments on hold to lure a company to our city doesn't make sense for the city or the company.
You're also one of the fastest growing cities in America, and it makes me wonder whether people are getting tired of that a little bit. People who live in San Antonio are seeing the downsides of all that growth, and they don't want so much more.
Growth is going to happen whether we have a plan for it or not. I think that in San Antonio, we have a plan for it, and we have to work to ensure that we're accommodating the growth that we know is a demographic reality in a way that helps us to boost the quality of life. And if we stay committed to the investments in, like I said, education, infrastructure, transportation, then we can meet that challenge. San Antonio has been innovating in the education space with a citywide model pre-kindergarten program. We have an opportunity to build upon air service regionally right here in the heart of the seventh largest city in the United States. We're working on a housing strategy that can help us maintain what has been a competitive advantage in terms of cost of living here in San Antonio. We're doing all that work proactively. In order for us to be a strong 5, 10, 30-year investment, we have to continue to be committed to that strategy. And we're going to do that. And that's the reason why we think we're a smart investment. It would show not so smart to compromise that future just to bring one company here.
How have the citizens of San Antonio reacted to your decision?
It's been mixed. I mean, I think the reality is most people understand that this is a public bidding war on a decision that might likely have already been made. And I think when you think about that, residents are seeing it the same way we do in the terms of let's stay committed to building the strong future for ourselves as San Antonians and the children that we have and the people who will move and call San Antonio home. We're a city that's going to be celebrating its tricentennial. But in many respects, we're at the beginning of a life cycle here in our city. So I think a lot of people are optimistic about that. Of course, when you have an RFP that's posted on a website that really has no additional details other than to essentially show me the money, it makes people scratch their head. But when the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is promising 50,000 jobs, six-figure salaries, and transformative infrastructure, of course, that's going to, make you want to pause and think about that. But we do have to be judicious. We have to be focused. And our pot at the end of the rainbow is the fact that we're building a strong future that we can all enjoy together here in San Antonio.
All right. Ron Nirenberg, the mayor of San Antonio, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And by the way, I asked the mayor, because of his unique position as someone who doesn't really want Amazon to come, who does he think's going to get it? He sort of avoided the answer.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell us.
Here it is, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.